Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
What's an internet troll?
I've heard of these. They emerged from Usenet after the Great Flame War of 99. They feed off of negative reaction.
Why are people so mean to each other online?
Should we just turn off the comment section? Just turn off the comment section. Just don't read that crap.
Who wrote that?
Anonymous.
Well, I'm responding to it.
Don't lower yourself to their level.
Look, I am simply going to defend our work, scientist to scientist. And failing that, suggest that his mother enjoys a string of both human and non-human lovers.
Do people behave any better online when they're not anonymous?
How do we as individuals foster a healthier online environment?
Why isn't it possible to have an online forum that encourages humility and politeness?
Our guest is Michael Lynch from the University of Connecticut, author of The Internet of Us.
Trolling, bullying, and flame wars. Humility and online discourse.
Brass monkey!
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hey, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being our partner. You've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that support. But we need your help now more than ever.
So here's what you do. Go to our website, philosophytalk.org, click the donate button, and help us make more of what we know you love.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Why is the internet so full of trolling, bullying, and flame wars?
Does the web make people nastier and more arrogant?
Or is it possible to cultivate more kindness and humility online?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're thinking about trolling, bullying, and flame wars as part of our ongoing series on intellectual humility.
You know, I have to confess something, Josh. I may be in a minority, but I actually love the internet. Some of my most rewarding conversations with friends and political allies, even political opponents, philosophical collaborators, and these people are spread out all over the world, have taken place over the web. It's an amazing tool.
Try hanging out in the comment section of 4chan, Ken, or even YouTube. I mean, these are places where you've got anonymous exchanges between strangers that are never going to meet each other, and they quickly devolve into bullying, trolling, name-calling. I mean, you name it, right? Or try confronting the online mobs that harass people they disagree with.
No thanks, Josh. I think I'll stay away from that.
Well, I thought you loved the internet.
I do. It doesn't mean I have to love mobs, though.
Well, you can't have one without the other.
Oh, Josh, come on. There have always been mobs and trolls. And no doubt there always will be. And now, sure, in the age of the internet, some of the mobs have moved online. But big deal.
Oh, it is a big deal. I mean, the internet has totally changed the face of bullying.
Oh, come on, Josh. You exaggerate. How?
Well, because people do things in cyberspace that they wouldn't do in everyday life. Psychologists actually have a name for it. It's called the online disinhibition effect.
The online... there's this fancy phenomenon with a fancy name that's hard to pronounce. But what's your point?
Well, the point is that the technology frees mobs from geographical restrictions. And that's a huge difference because they then become insulated both from the damage they cause and from any possibility of accountability or punishment.
Oh, you can't blame the internet for that. The internet, after all, is just a tool. It's like a hammer or a horse or whatever. And like any tool, it can be used for good or for ill. And besides, bullies will be bullies no matter the platform, Josh, online or off. It just doesn't matter.
Well, next thing you're going to tell me that guns don't kill people. People do.
I'd never say that. But look, I got to ask you, what's your alternative? Do you want to censor the internet like in China? Well, what, you don't believe in the free marketplace of ideas? Now, look, yeah, okay, the internet, because of the internet, the marketplace of ideas gets a little rough and tumble at times, but it's always been. That's the price we pay for freedom, Josh.
It's just becoming too high a price. I mean, we're witnessing the total degradation of public discourse.
Oh, come on, Josh, chill. Come on.
Look, there's a real danger to our democracy, Ken. I mean, people are losing their privacy. People are even dying as a result of bullying and doxing.
Gosh, I think you're being way too alarmist.
I don't think you're appreciating what happens to people on the internet.
It hasn't changed me or you. You're still the same cool guy I've always known.
it changes everybody at least a little bit, Ken. I mean, think about the bystander effect.
The bystander effect?
Well, you know, that's when people are less likely to help a victim if there are other people around who might lend a hand.
I know that. But what's that got to do with trolling and bullying? That's what I'm asking you.
Well, the point is that people's behavior can be radically distorted by the situation they find themselves in. And so now apply that to the situation of the internet, right? That's a situation where you're interacting with anonymous strangers that you're never going to see face to face. Well, that's going to make people behave badly. And even people that would ordinarily be meek as lambs, that's the problem with the internet.
That's not the problem with the internet per se. That's the problem with particular platforms. And you know what, Josh? If you don't like those platforms, just stop using them. Just walk away. And besides, maybe a little creativity, we can design new platforms that don't encourage bad actors.
Dream on. That's never going to happen. You're never going to be able to design a platform that solves those problems. Look, there's just something inherently antisocial about the internet.
Inherently? Oh, come on. Think about AI and the limitless possibilities of it. We could use AI maybe to moderate the comment sections automatically of these things. Or we could monitor for bullying via AI. We could even use it to zap the bullies through the web. What do you think about that, Josh?
Okay, so let me get you straight. Instead of having the government regulate the internet, you want AI to regulate the internet.
Well, yeah.
So instead of 1984, you want Blade Runner.
Josh,
much of a difference.
Josh, I'm obviously not getting through to you today. I'm afraid we're just going to have to agree to disagree.
Well, that's better than what happens online. And maybe this will convince you. Our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, took a look at a recent case of online harassment that may have been made worse by the internet. She files this report.
It had only been 47 minutes since a gunman opened fire inside a high school in Parkland, Florida. The death toll was unknown, the shooter not yet captured. And yet the conspiracy theorists, lurking in online forums and sites like 4chan, 8chan, Reddit, and Twitter, were already on the prowl.
The conspiracy theories, as they often do after a major mass violence event involving guns, began pretty much immediately.
Abigail Olheiser covers digital culture for The Washington Post. She says that after the shooting, conspiracy theorists took to the internet, describing the massacre as a hoax. A video claiming shooting survivor David Hogg was an actor paid to pose as a victim became the number one trending YouTube video.
And by that point, it then started to get media coverage, which had the simultaneous effect of calling out these conspiracy theories and also then amplifying them even further.
Conservative-minded Twitter users shared a doctored meme claiming to show Parkland survivor Emma Gonzalez ripping apart the U.S. Constitution. She was actually tearing a gun range target.
This meme went, pretty viral on the right-wing internet, and soon after that, you started seeing kind of more conspiratorial ideas creep into slightly more mainstream discourse.
What began as harassment among anonymous fringe groups online soon grabbed headlines. Jamie Bartlett, author of The Dark Net and People vs. Tech, says stirring up outrage is often exactly what online antagonists want.
The whole purpose of it is to react. I think most of the people that do this don't really believe anything they're saying. They're calibrating their words to try to cause the maximum offense possible.
A few years ago, Bartlett was determined to understand more about what drives online fringe cultures. So he dove deep inside the dark net, an encrypted network that can't be accessed with traditional web browsers.
This is where there are the illegal drugs markets like the infamous Silk Road, illegal images of children, terrorist propaganda, hacker services for hire.
And then there's the trolls. While touring the darknet, Bartlett met a self-described troll known as Zach. Like past generations of neighborhood watchdog-type trolls, he would target misogynistic and extremist communities, luring them into arguments designed to rile them up. Zach was frustrated by the new breed of trolls.
Trolling, in his mind, had become associated with rape threats and death threats and racism and all of this stuff, which he simply says that's not really trolling. That's just being a racist on the internet.
When Bartlett met some of the people scurrying anonymously in the dark web in the real world, they seemed a lot more friendly, more kind, and less menacing.
They are more afraid of you than you are of them. It's like a spider in your bathroom. They simply enjoy getting some rise out of people because there's nothing else for them to do.
The moral of the story, he says, may always be don't feed the trolls, don't take them seriously. But with online harassment, the victims on the other end of the computer screen are real people with real emotions.
I don't care if someone is playing, I don't care if they're being ironic, I don't care if they think they're trolling, that's not important.
Winnie Phillips is the author of This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, a book about online trolling and mainstream culture.
The important thing is to totally sidestep the discussion of what someone's motivations are and focus on the impact. What impact do those behaviors have?
Phillips says there's practically no way to distinguish between the attention-seeking jokester trolls and the people trapped in their delusions. It's almost impossible to separate whether this is a problem with the internet or with people.
Those spaces make it so that we just don't know. You don't know if someone is sharing a conspiracy theory because they genuinely believe that it's true, or if because they are simply trying to amplify the story to generate the most destructiveness that they can.
And Phillips says, you can't distinguish online between sarcasm and sincerity either. If someone were to ask philosophical questions about intellectual humility in a chat room, they might be serious. But it could also be a trap set by a troll lurking and waiting for someone new to flame. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating tour of the dark corners of the internet, Holly. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today we're thinking about trolling, bullying, and intellectual humility.
We're joined now by Michael Lynch, professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut and author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Okay, so Michael, you write a lot about the effects of the internet, especially on how we think, reason, and know. So, but tell me, how did you first get interested in this topic?
Well, I think the first time that I really got the bug of thinking about philosophy and the internet together was when a couple years ago with my daughter, I was just going through a sort of game of let's figure out the answers to some ordinary questions without using digital technology at all, just to see what would turn out. Some of those questions range from like how to put an engine together, which was hard anyway, to really what seemed like really simple ones, like what's the number for my local congressional representative? Turned out answering all these questions, right, turned out to be really hard. Because, you know, for example, go to the library, you ask somebody behind the desk for some help, and they say, there's the computer over there.
What are you asking me for?
Exactly. Exactly. And if you tell them like I did, no, you don't understand. I can't use the internet. They look at you like, okay, just back away. I mean, the point is that it turned out that trying to figure out how to know things without the internet now is sort of like, well, you know, I've never done this, but you know the people that like dress up in Civil War costumes, right? And they try to reenact the past.
You become a bizarre person.
That's what it was
person.
Like. So, right. I was reenacting the past.
So clearly
the past was only a few years ago, right?
Right, and clearly this counts as odd behavior nowadays. But what are the effects? I mean, so Ken and I were arguing a moment ago about whether the internet's just a neutral tool, as Ken was suggesting, or whether it might have an actual negative impact on the users.
Well, intrinsically.
Right, it might intrinsically be the kind of thing that prompts people in a bad direction. So what's your view on this?
I think that the internet itself, if you think about the internet as just a massive worldwide web that supports things like email, for example, that itself is not intrinsically good or bad. But I think it's a whole different question when you think about the internet in terms of the platforms that are on it. And most of the time, when we're talking about the internet now, an ordinary conversation, when we think about it, we're actually thinking about platforms, not the actual structure, right? The wires and so forth, and the cloud
right.
that sits behind it.
I mean,
and I think can be really bad.
I tend to agree, but let me push this a little bit. I mean, isn't it the case that our experience online is a kind of disembodied and often anonymous experience? Doesn't that have an effect?
Well, it certainly does have an effect. In fact, the being anonymous does lead to some of the very bad effects that you were talking about before. It's part of the intrinsic nature of many of those platforms. It's not particularly intrinsic to the internet itself, but now we might just be getting into semantics.
Yeah, you're making
go ahead.
You're making a fine distinction between the internet as a whole not necessarily being a neutral tool and certain platforms on the internet that exploit these internet capacities being themselves designed in such a way that they're intrinsically bad, but we'll have to explore this in some greater detail. I know philosophers love distinctions, and that's important.
It's important to make these distinctions or trolls get onto you online.
Exactly. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about intellectual humility and the internet with Michael Lenz from the University of Connecticut.
Have you ever been tempted to troll or bully someone on the internet? Do you think the internet brings out the worst in people? Has it made us less humble and more arrogant?
Humility, arrogance, and the internet, plus your calls and emails, troll-free, when Philosophy Talk continues. Is there a difference between bullying on the playground and being a bully online? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, and we're asking about trolling, bullying, and intellectual humility online. Our guest is Michael Lenz from the University of Connecticut, author of The Internet of Us.
So, Michael, you, Josh, and I all seem to believe that a lot of online discourse is a mess. I'm not quite sure we agree about what causes it. So I want you to say more about why you think this messy, awful bullying discourse happens, and what are the features of various platforms, whether intrinsic or not, that promotes this kind of thing?
Well, I think one thing to say right away is that a lot of our social platforms, let's take Facebook as an example. Why not beat up on them? Everybody else is right now.
Well, they're deserving it right now.
Right, indeed. They've been asking for it, as a troll might say. But one of the features of those sorts of platforms is they have a sense of immediacy to them. If they're a successful platform, that's because they manage to sort of get us into thinking that we're connecting with people emotionally via the platform, and oftentimes that actually is the case. But they, as a result, they sometimes can make people think that, well, we're actually in a real conversation here. But then, of course, the thing that we talked about right before the break, the fact that people are also anonymous online, even on platforms like Facebook, where lots of people, of course, are not anonymous, but they can be if they want to. That combination can make people particularly vulnerable.
Yeah.
Because if I'm opening myself up to you, right, and you take advantage of that fact by dropping in like a hurricane onto the conversation and or posing as somebody you're not, that can really, really be painful.
So you're saying it's kind of a bait and switch kind of thing, it sounds like you're saying. Is that how I'm hearing? I mean, it's like it gives you this illusion of like an intimate conversation in which you want to be open. But the reality is, and I've been thinking about this a lot recently, the reality of it is that it's also a drop-in conversation. That is, people in an intimate conversation, the stranger, if he or she is overhearing you, is intruding, and that's not good. But Facebook opens you up to all these people. They may be your Facebook friends, but in reality, they're strangers. So it's like it invites you to have this sense of intimacy, but it invites the stranger to like be an interloper.
And one of the things that I think is the case is we don't really have norms or rules that are widely accepted on how to handle this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, if you're in a bar and you're talking to somebody and somebody else comes up out of the blue and just interrupts, right, and starts talking, well, both of the first two people are generally know what to do. They sort of ignore the other person or try to get them out of the way, or they say, excuse me, we were talking here, and things like that. That is sort of seen as rude behavior in most cases, especially if the person being particularly aggressive.
And that sort of
feels like that online, but a lot of times, because we don't know who people are, it's really hard to know how to navigate situations like the drop-in troll that you just talked about.
We don't have rules. We also aren't psychologically prepared because there's nothing in everyday life that's like this, right, where you have an intimate conversation or something that seems like an intimate conversation, but it turns out that, well, you're on Twitter, let's say, right? You might feel like you're talking to one person, but in fact, anyone who wants to eavesdrop can.
In fact, yeah, exactly. It's much more like, talking on the radio. That point about psychological attitudes, I think, is really important. Because I think, you know, if we move past bullying and trolls in the sort of most overt way, and you just think about what it is about our actions on social platforms and our life, our digital form of life that we're living right now, that can set us up for harmful public discourse. I think one of the things that it does is not just encourage bad behavior per se, but it encourages in all of us, present company included, I'm afraid, at least with me, a type of arrogance. You mentioned that word before. I think it's what I just want to define it in a particular way. What I mean by it here is a sort of intellectual or epistemic arrogance, and I think of that as the attitude I have when I think that there's nothing that somebody has to teach me. Nobody has anything to teach me about some particular issue. I know it all already. That know-it-allism is something that the structure of our platforms really can encourage.
So I can maybe buy that, but I'm not sure I'd go as far as saying that everyone is going to be affected in the same way. So, I mean, you know, I think about my own behavior online. I'm capable of getting irritated and shirty, as we Brits like to say. But I don't think I would ever issue someone a death threat, for example.
Well, I don't think you would, Josh. I know you. You're a great guy. But I want to reject it in another way. I don't mean for Josh and I to pile up on you. Well, yes, I do. And then you can respond to...
Are we bullying our guest?
No, I don't. What you call...
Stop picking on me.
Michael, what you call arrogance, I'm not sure if I'd call it arrogance. I mean, I see that. But I think there's also another response that may seem more rational to people. It's a kind of defensiveness. That is, look, we were evolved for conversations in the small circle where people are mutually committed to the same kind of goals. And the internet opens us up to all comers with all different kind of goals in what has the feel of a conversation but isn't really a conversation, right? So we're not jointly committed. And when all these interlopers come in, or what I want to see as interlopers come in, it's not so much that I get arrogant and I know nothing, but I get defensive and I want to defend myself from your constant intrusion onto this little shared space. So I don't know, maybe one person's arrogance is another person's online defensiveness. What do you think about that?
I think they're actually deeply connected. I think that's a really great point about defensiveness, because let's just think about arrogance in general. People who are arrogant, who have that sort of know-it-all attitude, those people, even if they do know it all, in fact, they do know a lot about that particular subject, when they're being arrogant, they're actually being self-defensive. When you think about, I think about the times when I find myself being arrogant, which is, you know, like pretty much every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I'm often doing it because I do have a sort of, I'm privileging my self-esteem. I want to protect that self-esteem, and I want to protect the group that I'm in. If I, you know, part of what happens is we can go fall into sort of tribal arrogance too, right? Which
right.
is what, you know,
right.
my side's got it all figured right. out, people, right? And we get defensive about our tribe, not just about ourselves.
So it sounds
because, of course, our tribe is part of ourselves.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it sounds like there are actually multiple sources of internet bad behavior, right? So there's the kind of thing that Holly was talking about, the actual sociopaths, the people who thrive on causing trouble.
Right, right.
There's this tribal mentality. There's more generalized arrogance. Maybe we should also add things like, you know, Stendhal has this lovely phrase, impotent rage, that people are increasingly feeling disempowered, and maybe this is a way for certain folks to try to seize a sense of control over their lives and power, not a good way. But so I wonder, do you think there are multiple sort of psychological factors pushing people to behave badly?
Yeah, I really do. And I'd add another one, too, which is a sort of structure of many of the platforms we use encourage a type of personalized experience. In fact, that personalization is how the magic on the internet actually happens. Everything that we read on the internet, from the news sites we check to the ads that come down our Facebook feed, all that stuff is highly personalized. And it's personalized because platforms like Google, of course, track all of our online behavior and the behavior of every single person on the planet, which is almost every single person on the planet who uses that platform. And they use that to predict both the questions we're going to ask and the answers that we want, right? They,
yeah.
you know, Google
right.
Complete, right? You type in, right, climate change. Your readers can try this at home right now. Climate change is a in Uh-oh. Google, and it'll give you some suggestions,
oh,
right?
For
like, is a hoax or
oh my gosh.
Is it, you know, it'll suggest some
so
things,
you're talking
right?
About the, you're talking about the filter bubble that people are trapped in.
Exactly. And I'm saying that those bubbles are partly created by the way that our platforms allow us to both encourage us to ask certain questions and then encourage certain answers. And what that ends up doing is feeding back into this sort of idea that, well, we've got it figured out. Look, right. I have yeah. all the answers, yeah. right? They're right there.
Right,
Google
right.
it, we tell each other. Right. Google it. I know I'm right.
So Michael, I want to let another Michael in here as a caller. So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about intellectual humility, the possibility or impossibility of it online, and we'd love to have your contribution, humble as it may be. And another Michael from Boston's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael. What's your comment or question?
Yes, a couple of quick things before I get to what I was going to say. And
make it one quick thing, okay?
Okay. Just to say that the personalization brings into reality a paranoid schizophrenic's ideas of reference. And really, what I was called in to say is that the Internet has not been the same since they let people who couldn't code HTML onto it.
In what way? Tell me more, Michael. In what
well,
way?
Well, I was on
that?
The Internet before it was the web,
right.
And it was designed largely by academics and researchers, and certainly there are horrible people in academia, but even when there was anonymous, even when people used handles, if someone were particularly obnoxious, you could go to the sysop of the system they were on and report them. So there was that. As to the thing that I added that I didn't say I was going to say, paramount, or one of the prime symptoms of paranoid schizophrenia is the idea that things in the universe are talking especially to you and designed for you. And on the Internet, that's real. So, in some ways, it's not strange that it helps support paranoia.
Okay, Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Josh, you want to say something?
Yeah,
about
I think
Michael,
it's a fantastic point because, look, the Internet or many of these platforms were created at a time when we were talking about a small community of users who, relatively speaking, knew each other and could trust each other. And so we've just expanded things out without really thinking hard about what we would need to change.
Yeah. So, Michael Lynch, what do you think about that?
I think it's a really, really fascinating point as well. I agree with Josh. I mean, I think not only have we expanded the numbers of people using it, but the caller, Michael, was pointing out that the people who are using the Internet, that is all of us, including myself right now, we really don't know fundamentally how most of it works. That is, we don't understand most of the platforms. Now, in one sense, that's not much different than the fact that I don't know how my television works or my toaster works or my car works. Or, you know, we live in a technological society where technical expertise is not had by the majority of the population that uses the technology. Nonetheless, the difference here is that most of us don't know even that the Internet is personalized. Most people are not even aware of how the Internet functions as an economic tool, and we can see that in those Facebook hearings just last week.
No, you're right.
Where the senators were like asking basic questions like, well, how do you make your money if it's free? We run ads, Senator.
The people don't realize that on Facebook they're the product, not the customer, and that Facebook is devoted to analyzing, collecting, marshaling their data in any way they can get away with and selling it off to other people. But that's certainly true. But I want to go back to another point. I think you're right. I think you and Josh and the other Michael are right. There's something really deep. It's that ordinary ways we have of going about knowing things, believing things, talking to people, the Internet radically disrupts all those things, and nobody really foresaw the effects of that radical disruption, right? So it's like we're in a brave new world that's completely unanticipated. That's what it seems to me. Because, right. Like, who do you trust? What source do you trust? When there are a plethora of possible sources, none of them marked as intrinsically or authoritative, and you've got to believe this and believe that on the basis of this? I mean, who do you trust? And why do you trust them? And then, since that's such a hard problem to solve, you decide who to trust and decide who to filter out. You call that arrogance and know-it-allism. I still think it's a kind of defensiveness against an onslaught of information that comes at you with no, like, intrinsic mark of believability or authority or anything like that. What do you think about that tirade?
Well, I think there's a lot there, although I want to push back on one point.
Good.
I think that for a long time, we did feel sort of overwhelmed with information on the internet. And if you look back on book titles that came out, let's say about 10 years ago, a little bit sooner than that, we had lots of things like the information overload, flood was another one.
Yeah.
The idea was that we had is that we couldn't deal with all this stuff and just the thing you're articulating. But I think right now, actually, that feeling for most people has really gone away. And I think that's even more worrying.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's not that the flood has changed.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Just that it's, you know, we've become used to it.
Because they've developed a strategy for coping with it. It's the tribalism. It's the information cocoon. It's a response. And in a way, it's an effective response because it does tamp down, right, the jungle of information to something you can manage. But that tamping it down is driven by confirmation bias and all kinds of cognitive
And forward. By the platforms that are designed to allow it to be easier for you to find that restaurant where you are, get the directions to it, find out what other people think about it, which is fantastic when you're looking for a restaurant. But when you're looking for information on a political candidate or trying to figure out immigration policy and what you think about it, that sort of personalization, that way in which the internet is like a self-driving car that takes you where it thinks you want to go, that is
a recipe for disaster. Yeah. We got a caller to try to get her in for the break. Alicia from Berkeley, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question?
Well, I've been wondering for a while why it seems that the discourse on these, you know, various platforms has gone down rather than up. Mm. So in the old days, I'm aging myself, it seems like people, you know, would tell racist or sexist or whatever jokes in private with sort of their similar group, but you wouldn't necessarily see that on TV or in the newspapers, et cetera. And I know that our lovely president with his reprehensible tweets has certainly contributed to this, but even before he became president, it seems like rather than feeling less permission to say these things in public, people feel more permission.
So, Alicia, I think you're right, and I think Michael can answer that, because I think the point he made about the personalization of the internet, I think will help illuminate your point, but I'm guessing you think that, Michael. Am I right or wrong?
You are absolutely right. I think it's a great point, and I was waiting, of course, for the world's most famous Twitter feed to come up, because when we talk about the normalization of bad behavior on the internet, Real Donald Trump certainly does play a part. And part of what's happened here is that, as Ken was saying, we live in these filtered bubbles where when we say something that is harmful or hurtful to the tribe on the other side, we get all this confirmation and support from those of us who agree. So it's not that we're getting censored, right? There's no internet mom that comes in and says, Michael Patrick Lynch, you stop that bad behavior online right now.
Right.
Well, no, of course, that's one of, again, I agree with you that not everything is terrible, but the fact that crackpots can find so much support now.
Right.
That's a real feature.
It is a real feature and not a bug by some designer's lights, but maybe by our social life's light, it's a bug. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about intellectual humility and online discourse with Michael Lynch from the University of Connecticut.
Can we design online platforms that lead to more kindness and less bullying, more humility, less arrogance? Can we as consumers create a better online experience for everyone?
Kindness, humility, and a better internet for all. When Philosophy Talk continues.
I don't like your tweet, sir. Will. Teach you the professor's ready. Not. Let's see who strikes the loudest. Lou. Put on my fighting trousers. Sorry, I'm sorry, Jeffrey, but it gets my goat. Gets my dander right up. It's bloody told him. No jazz solo. This is supposed to be a diss song. Jeffrey, get off the drums.
Leave it to the Brits. If only all online flame wars were as polite and civil as they are in Chap Up.
I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy. Our guest is Michael Lynch from the University of Connecticut, and we're asking about trolling, bullying, and humility online. We received an email from Sam in San Francisco. Sam says, what drives people to want followers online so desperately? How does this facilitate or grow bullying? What do you think, Michael?
Well, I think in that case, and I think what drives people to want followers online are two things. One, basic human psychology. One of the things that platforms like Twitter and Facebook initially really figured out is that people like to be liked. No kidding. And but you take that, like a lot of businesses that are successful, right? You take something really simple like that, really simple, and you turn it into a platform. People like to be liked. That's what drives people. But the other thing is, of course, is that once you do understand the system, you realize that those likes actually, of course, are the economic drivers for things like targeted advertising.
Right.
So, economic reasons, again, another human and universal, that, people like money, is also what drives.
Which leads to another thing that I realized this belatedly just the other day when I was thinking about you are the product on Facebook. I actually said this in a Facebook forum, and a lot of people saying, well, it's a good bargain, blah, blah, blah. And I thought about emojis. Right. And people's demand for more and more emojis so that they could respond to things with more nuance, the emotional indicators. Right. But and they were like complaining to Facebook about more and more. And you know what? I realized Facebook was like, sure, I'll give you more emojis because that gives me much more data about you. Right.
Exactly.
Because, like this? Do you have like this? Does this make you angry? It's like you're constantly in an experiment with Facebook for what drives you. And they don't do anything except exploit that information.
Can I pick up on something we were talking about a moment ago? So people like to be liked, right? So I'm curious, looking forward, right, on the question whether there's anything we can do about the current situation, are we just talking about, Michael, are we just talking about basically a fixed set of capacities and propensities that human beings have? So people like to be liked, things like that. Or is there anything we can do? I mean, can education intervene? Yeah. I mean, can we change people's souls to make it more likely to behave well?
And I know you're the man to tell us this because you lead a research program on just how to improve intellectual humility on the internet, right? So tell us some of the highlights of your own research.
So one of the things that let me just pick up on the things about the emoticons on Facebook. One of the things that we're learning is the degree to which those emoticons, the happy face, the sad face, the outrage face, right, that are on is how much they shape online comedy. People, and listeners can verify this for themselves. If Ken posts something and I see that all of our friends already are outraged by it, then I'm probably not, first of all, going to feel peer pressure, right, not to like it. Moreover, if I do also go outrage face, it shapes how I'm going to interact with the post, why I'm going to share it, and what I'm going to say about it.
Right.
It's not as if you do outrage face and then you say, actually, this has a lot of very interesting points. You should consider this. Look into it more carefully. That's not how it goes. So
that's my style. Think, why are you knocking my style?
Right. One of the things that you need to do is to get people to be aware of the way in which how they interact with the platform can affect their behavior. But it also might lead to us thinking about, well, what about ways of reacting that aren't having to do with emoticons? Those are emotional reactions. Nothing wrong with emotions, but they're not, let's say, and this is sort of a joke, but not really. Think of what if we had reactive buttons that said something like, probably justified by the evidence,
yeah,
probably not
right.
justified, and I'm not sure I need more information.
So let me ask, it sounds like you're suggesting, and maybe your research has shown this, or some research has shown this, it sounds like you're suggesting, which would be a hopeful thing, if you make people more reflective about the consequences of various forms of online behavior, like which emoticon you choose to react to something, right, then that has the potential to ameliorate
their behavior in some way or other. Is that what you're suggesting? Is that really
that
a
is,
robust?
That is what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that actually also we can think about designing our platforms to make us more reflective. We have 10 global teams working on these sorts of topics. And one of the teams is interested in, led by Graham Smith out in Westminster. You know, one of the things they're interested in is restructuring commenting sections and online platforms. And one way to do that is to try to experiment with different ways that those platforms can run. And while, of course, the research is still ongoing, some of the suggestions that I'm making right now are coming out of thinking about some of the research that we have developed.
So this is really fascinating. It's really fascinating. But I'm going to ask you, I don't want to sound cynical, right? Pure research is one thing, and then the economic exploitation. Are there incentives in the market economy, right? I mean, Google, Facebook, are there incentives for them to adopt these platforms that will make for more responsible, more humble, if you will, intellectually humble online behavior? Or the economic incentives all against that? So we got two different things pushing.
I think, again, turning to sort of human universals, it's rarely the case, I'm afraid, in my opinion, that there are economic incentives to be ethical.
Yeah, right.
If you want people to be ethical and to be just, and you want a society that's more interested in actually working together and listening to each other, then you're going to need to engage in social reform, and that means changing norms. And that's tough, dirty work. It's political work. It's philosophical work, but you can't avoid it. There's no technological magic solution to this problem. Yeah, we can make our platforms better, of course, but you've hit the nail right on the head that if we really want to get people to change, we've got to change incentives. Well, how do you change incentives if you can't, you know, you can't just make money off of ethics?
So
you've got to change norms.
So I hear you, and it resonates to a lot of things I've been thinking about, but here's the thing that gets me. So I'm kind of, in some ways, a Habermasian, in the sense that I believe that there's what he calls a logic of rational discourse, there's a kind of communicative rationality, such that when you're engaging a conversation, and a conversation is a mutually constraining search for truth, you don't want the mere manipulation, you don't want this, that, and the other thing. Okay, to the extent that we are committed to democracy and equality and stuff like that, then it seems to me we should be committed as a collectivity to something like what Habermas calls communicative rationality. But I have begun to despair that we really are committed to the logic of communicative rationality in this Habermasian sense, and I don't know how we get you know what I mean? I mean, speech is about persuasion and manipulation and not like a mutual search for truth and the force of the better reason. How do we do this? How do we get, you know?
Well, I think one thing, I mean, first of all, I completely agree with you, though. I would just push back one thing, which is that, you know, in general, we might say that, you know, ethics, well, you know, at the end of the day, we all have our sort of Glauconian or Thrasymachean moments where we're like, you know, at the end of the day, screw this. Just go out for yourself because nothing is ever going to work and we really can't change things. Well, yeah, human beings are not often nice to each other. And we've got to figure out ways to work around that. Right now, what we're seeing on the internet is just technologies and platforms that, as we've been discussing, encourage particularly undemocratic attitudes. And what we've got to do is go back to the example that I suggested. We can, you know, so coming back off of the cynicism a little bit, think about certain concrete things you can do. One thing you can do is educate. For example, here's a concrete example. Suppose that we need to educate people about how much of their data is being taken online. We talked about that before. Why? Because that's part of the background conditions that are allowing people to be manipulated on the internet. So, you know, it would be great if we were able to sort our apps online in a quick, easy way of doing it. When you're on the Google Store, you're on any particular platform looking at different apps to buy, and you were searching, let's say, for a flashlight ad or something like that, you would want to be able to search for it in a way that said this app, for example, takes more of your request more of your data. And if you're going to download this app, it's going to request more of your data. Now, Google and other platforms do get you that information if you really look for it.
Yeah.
But if it allowed us to easily sort things by how much data they're taking, that would actually educate people in a very, very quick way.
I agree.
We have to provide norms to make that happen.
Right. But and I also think...
That's not a crazy thought. Right?
No, not at all. And I'm actually even maybe more ambitious. I think maybe we could... focus more on education, as it were, for virtue. I mean, cultivate the desire to interact in a kind of Habermasian way with our fellow human beings. But it seems to me we've got three main possibilities, right? Educate people for virtue on the one side, the highly optimistic maybe. And then the highly cynical one is people are never going to be, never going to change. They're always going to have bad motivations. And so we just kind of ward those off by means of technology. In the middle, I think we have nudges. We set the defaults, right? We set up our response emoticons and whatever in such a way as to make it more likely rather than less likely that people will behave in the way that we want.
So why don't you give us your last thought, and then we'll have to say goodbye to you, unfortunately, Michael.
My last thought is just picking up on the idea that in order to educate for virtue, we first need to just start by educating period. And that means getting people to read stuff, interact with other people, and have an attitude that they, we're willing to learn from people who are different from us. That's the trick, is to get people to have that sort of humility, the idea that they're not know-it-alls, and not be so defensive.
Yeah, Michael, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I really thank you for joining. You've been a great guest.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Our guest has been Michael Lynch. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Connecticut. He's author of The Internet of Us, Knowing More and Understanding Less in the Age of Big Data. I'm in the middle of reading that book. I highly recommend it to you. So, Josh, are you humbled? Are you defensive?
Yeah, and look, in the spirit of humility, I've got to say, this is a very difficult topic. And, part of it is a lot of these things are the two sides of the same coin. The very same anonymity that creates these problems is also very empowering for disadvantaged and disempowered groups. And, so it's really tricky. We've got to be able to tamp down some of this bad behavior while still allowing the space for all the important conversations to flourish.
Which means that it's a really complex design problem in which multiple forces converge and interact. And I don't think we've begun to imagine a better space. I mean, we have begun, but we're such a long way. Michael is encouraging. His research is encouraging and fascinating. But you know what? This conversation continues. It will continue at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto, with apologies to Descartes, is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner, and please do, in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on our blog. Now a man who can outrun any troll. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the rise of the internet has damaged many things. Taxi cabs, bookstores, movie attendants, newspapers, and apparently civility. Though I have to say, we were plenty rude before modems and Wi-Fi came along. One of my biggest pastimes as a boy was the Would You Rather game. Would you rather be blind or deaf? Would you rather lose an arm or a leg? And as the sleepover got later, the game became more morbid and exotic. Would you rather be rolled down a hill in a barrel full of nails or shot out of a clown cannon into an active volcano? Ah, yes, the ages 8 to 10 are magical years for American boys, and that age seems to be the sweet spot for the internet, culture-wise. Slightly disturbed preteen boys, highly territorial with mysterious yet inflated sense of what is right. All that preteen boy behavior wandered into cyberspace. Trolling is the equivalent of, go ahead, knock it off, I dare ya, or calling somebody out for wearing yellow on Thursday, which makes you a morphidite, whatever that is, and therefore eligible for a fistfight. Trolls come into your clubhouse, make fun of what you stand for, and ruin everything. And bullying, of course, knows no age or boundaries. You can't really say they've gotten more nuanced, but I would say flame wars today are easier to cause. And you might not even know why. Who was the best Felix Leiter? Was T.S. Eliot a good poet? Who won World War II? Springsteen versus Dylan? Weigh in. Almost anything can be clickbait for a war. Also, certain trigger words can cause fire to shoot out of people's heads at great distances. Trump, Roseanne, Hillary, single shooter. Trial lawyers, politically correct, Stormy Daniels, Confederate statues, Kennedy, Vietnam, gun control, you name it. Blame wars are bigger than ever, but they spread into the real world via Twitter, becoming news in and of themselves. Real news versus fake news, Trump collusion versus Hillary emails. On a more mundane level, send a tweet saying you've just had the best barbecue in the world, for example, then sit back and wait for the death threats to come in. It takes so little to trigger so much. Star Wars versus Star Trek, Kirk versus Picard, Boba Fett versus, what are you even talking about? Marvel versus DC, the Stones versus the Beatles, John versus Paul, frivolous lawsuits versus justice for all. Political correctness versus just quit being a racist, sexist jerk. How hard is that, really? Wearing labels and coffee versus just move to Alabama if you think California sucks so bad. Roger Moore versus Sean Connery. Vaccines, veganism, fluoridation. I'm on fire. Edward versus Jacob. Haney versus Annette. Spin versus Marty. Mind versus body. Mods versus rockers. Jets versus sharks. Skins, shirts, innate, acquired, filtered, unfiltered. Boys, girls, curly versus shrimp. Pudding versus proof. Yes versus no. Intuition versus cold, hard reason. Renaissance versus enlightenment. The infield fly rule versus what? Evolution versus creationism. Netflix versus Amazon. Upstairs, downstairs. East coast, west coast. Neo soul, hip hop. Acid house, future pop. Headphones versus speakers as big as your couch. Artisanal versus store-bought, millennial versus boomer, wide wheel versus narrow wheel, corduroys, high-top sneakers, jury's out, pension plans, pro-life, pro-choice, Mac versus PC, raise versus fold, daylight savings time, just stop it, golden age versus silver age, Batman versus Superman. The wars can go on for years, usually fueled by men until they get hoarse from shouting. Women don't go in for flame wars so much. They tend to just talk about something until it turns into something they can talk about, whereas men will eventually either call you Hitler or a cuck snowflake and walk away. Which is why there's no wall at the border, all the bridges are falling down, healthcare is too expensive, and mansplaining is still a thing. Scream in all caps if you disagree. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2018.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeyer, Emily King, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Tastes great.
Less filling.
Tastes great.
Less filling.
Tastes great.